disarming introduction. I mean, it almost breaks my spirit, my hostility that I had already built up for the day. So thank you, Bob, and thank you, Rolf, in particular, who are, I would say, the fathers of this meeting. I think that was conceived somewhere 13, 14 years ago, down in the Reeperbahn. At the Reeperbahn somewhere, 13 or 14 years ago, between Rolf and long before AIDS, I assume. So today I would like to address the subject that Bob just mentioned, that is the role of proto-oncogenes in cancer, in any cancers. Proto-oncogenes, as you, I'm sure you're aware of, even if you attended one of the sessions here, are cellular genes which are defined by their, biochemically defined by their structural relationship to retroviral oncogenes or transforming genes. We know about 20 retroviral oncogenes now, therefore we know about 20 proto-oncogenes. As soon as we find a new retroviral oncogene, we know a new retroviral proto-oncogene as well. Now, proto-oncogenes are functionally completely black boxes to date. We don't know about a single one of them exactly what it does. Two of the 20, we have at least a structural idea. One is related to a growth factor and the other to a growth factor receptor. It was discussed even this afternoon. But they are not the same as these growth factors or the growth factor receptors either. Now, because they are structurally related to retroviral oncogenes, it is now generally widely believed that they are potential oral carcinogens already. And it is that subject which has, I think, monopolized the journals, from Nature to Wall Street Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, and even some more serious journals like Virology and PNAS. Now, I would like to discuss briefly now what the retroviral transforming genes are, because I think people have forgotten now what the definitions of retroviral transforming genes are, in order to compare that to what I think proto-oncogenes are, at least what we know about them, and what we think about them, how they would transform cells. The retroviral oncogenes are the only obligatory carcinogens that we know to date, as far as I know at least, and I invite anybody to interrupt if I say something that's heretical here. And they're also the fastest acting carcinogens. And in fact, they are the only genes that initiate and maintain tumors per se. They don't need another helper gene, they don't need a carcinogen, they don't need a helper cell, they do that all by themselves. This has been proven genetically with some, not all, retroviral transforming genes. Using temperature-sensitive mutants, for example, it has been proven for the Sark gene of Raus sarcoma virus, for Kirsten sarcoma virus, for Fujinami virus, and to some degree for avian erythroblastosis virus, again, as Mike Heyman pointed out this afternoon. And it has been proven also with deletion mutants of some other viruses, but it has not been proven for all retroviral transforming genes. However, since it is likely, I think, that all retroviral transforming genes, including Abelson virus, as we discussed with Jeff Cooper earlier this morning, are sufficient to initiate and to maintain tumors for one particular reason, and I think that is a rather obvious reason. Where as soon as a cell is infected by a retroviral transforming gene, that cell will be transformed. It is almost a simultaneous event. That's why the word slow viruses is actually, I think, a sneaky word. It either works or it doesn't work, but if the transforming gene gets into a susceptible cell, that cell is a tumor cell as soon as the provirus is made and the provirus is integrated. This high transformation efficiency virtually eliminates or excludes a selection of a pre-neoplastic cell in which a step has already been taken toward neoplastic transformation. That is, the retroviral transforming gene does everything by itself. Of course it needs a cell, it is still a parasite, it needs cellular everything to transform, but it doesn't need another gene to do the job. Now, that is the hallmark, the functional hallmark of a retroviral transforming gene. Now, structurally, as we've shown over, I guess, the first Wilsiter meeting, talked about that already 12 years ago, their characteristic is that they are biochemically different from the essential virion genes of retroviruses. They were first identified simply by subtracting deletion mutants, which had lost transforming genes, in this case we used Raus, from a replicating retrovirus with the three essential virion genes, GERG, POL, and ENF. There was something left over that was called XDEN and SARC and ONC and YES and NO and MYC and FLY and FIPS and anything these days. But it is, the bottom line is, it is a sequence that is not needed by the virus. It is not needed for replication. It's not a survival gene by the virus. The virus needs it like a head in the hole. It is a parasite of the retrovirus. In fact, what is happening here is the retrovirus is being taken for a ride. It is probably a cellular gene which escapes the cellular dictatorship, if you want so, to have a free ride in the retrovirus. And like all escapists, they have a few fun rides, and then they get dumped too. And that's exactly what happens to retroviral transforming genes. They never make it outside the retroviral vector. They don't survive, and that's why, although these viruses are obligatory carcinogens, the best carcinogens we have in freezers and incubators, in life or outside in nature, they don't do well at all. After a few rounds of replication, they will be deleted and interfered with the helper virus, and they will be lost again. So the hallmark of the ONC gene is a sequence that is not needed by the virus, that is not essential, and all retroviral ONC genes, which have been compared to cellular prototypes from which they were derived by some kind of transaction, I'll come to that in a second, are different from the cellular proto-ONC genes. As Bob already pointed out in introduction, we have pointed out that before, and I'll reiterate it briefly. The retroviral transforming genes and the corresponding cellular prototypes are never isogenic. They differ in unique coding sequences from each other, and they always differ in regulatory sequences. This is perhaps most convincingly demonstrated if you look at what is by now the majority of the retroviral transforming genes, the so-called hybrid ONC genes. These are made of elements derived from essential virion genes, like GERG, typically in many of them, and elements derived from cellular genes, which are called proto-ONC genes. So in many of the GERG MYC proteins, the 5' half of the GERG gene is linked to a 3' half of a cellular gene. If you have a look at the first slide, I have only 5 or 6 of them. This is the table of retroviral transforming gene, which was current about a year ago. You can see here those three letter words in the middle are the letters which represent the cell-derived sequences. And those three letter words flanking them are elements derived from essential virion genes. If you just look at it as a picture from a distance, you see the majority are hybrid ONC genes. For all of the hybrid ONC genes, it's true what I already said. They are never isogenic with cellular genes, simply because cellular genes are not linked to elements of retroviruses like GERG or ENF or POL. In fact, some of them have now, in the last year already, moved out of the class of ONC genes made entirely from cell-derived sequences into hybrid genes. Howard Temin just showed that the REL gene is a hybrid gene, and there is at least a small question about the MOS. So there are very few left which are made that way. Now, we are now comparing or analyzing. I just want to keep that short. I want to concentrate on the more general issues. In collaboration with Takis Pappas, again, Bob mentioned that already, several of these hybrid ONC genes, simply to define what are actually the 5' and 3' ends. What is a complete proto-ONC gene? Most definitions of proto-ONC genes end at the boundaries of overlap with the viral transforming genes. Usually, the characterization stops there, and that may be a mistake. As you will see on the next slide here, these are the viruses which we are studying now in collaboration with Takis. One of them is the MC29 virus, which was the first virus. Oh, these are two together, I think. This is the MC29 virus is the first one in which a hybrid ONC gene was found. It is the acute leukemia or carcinoma virus. And in that virus, a part of the GERG gene is linked to a sequence which is now called MYC, which is derived from a cellular proto-ONC gene that is now, well, it's called proto-MYC, and that, as we had shown by cloning lately and sequencing with Takis Pappas, consists of three different... that could have worked, but... Okay, now you're moving the other direction. But that gene consists of three different exons. The virus has acquired from that exon, from these three exons, two, and has linked them to an element of the GERG gene. Now, of the same prototype, another retrovirus has been has been manufactured, if they want to, and that is called MH2. It's also a virus that has a broad oncogenic spectrum, like MC29, causes carcinomas, and it has used that same information to build a somewhat different gene. The one after that would be... Oh, that's not... Yeah, that's one. Okay, you can see here, that is the MC29 virus. The transforming gene is a hybrid derived from an essential variant gene, GERG, and a part of the proto-MYC gene. Those two are defined by one protein product, which they encode, 110,000 Dalton, in molecular weight, which, according to sequence analysis that, again, Takis Pappas has carried out, is probably the only major protein that this virus can make, and therefore must be the transforming protein. There are other reasons to believe this. Now, it has taken these two exons and a little bit of that first exon into the virus and link that to the cell. And you see in the cell, we have an exon here which is not shared with the virus, and the virus has 1.5 kilobases GERG which are not shared with the cell. So the bottom line is the two genes are not isogenic. Here's MH2. Dominique Staelin discussed it this morning. We are working on that too. And Janssen in the audience here is working on that too with Klaus Bister. And you can see that has taken these two exons plus part of that intron and conserve the splice acceptor site, and with the splice donor from GERG, uses this as one transforming gene, or probable transforming gene, and has made a hybrid with a sequence that is, we call MHT, for short for MH2 virus, that is a potential second transforming gene. This virus would be a model for a two-stage carcinogenesis. I'll come back to that in 1 second. And OK10 is yet another virus which has done very much like what MH2 has done with the MYC sequence, has picked it up together with an intron region. Peter Seberg is just sequencing that now with us, and it has the same exon intron structure here with the splice acceptor. But at the same time, that MYC sequence is treated as a hybrid gene in which the complete GERG, part of Paul, thank you, and the MYC gene is read through as one complete fused protein for transformation. Now, there are a few exceptions to this. I said some transforming genes are made entirely from the cell. And those were the ones which have initially led to the hypothesis that viral transforming genes and cellular products or progeny are the same. The model for that was the Src gene of Raus sarcoma virus. If you could just jump maybe one or two slides, I'll explain briefly that even in that case, the homology isn't true. This is just graphically, it's a wonderful drawing I thought that Takis Pappas did. That shows here the MYC sequence in MH2. That's the intron from the cell. Here's the splice acceptor. And that is the other sequence, the MH2 sequence, that is also in that virus. Okay. For those colors, we don't need it. Red, yellow, and blue. Okay. Next. Thank you. Next one, please. One more. Well, this is some more, as Bob Gallo pointed out, we do some work in the lab, we also bullshit a lot. But here's another class, that is the Fujinami virus. It's essentially a carbon copy almost of the MC29 virus, also a hybrid. Here's a variant that has a deletion and has lost lots of transforming function. And here's the proto-FIPS gene, which we are in the process now of analyzing completely. They are coterminal at the 3' end, but the 5' end has yet to be identified. Again, Peter Seberg has sequenced around 500 nucleotides here in one afternoon, and we hope he has some time left to sequence the rest of it. He goes at the rate of a kilobase a day when he's going. And here is the avian myeloblastosis virus, which has, has been mentioned this morning. This virus, unlike the FIPS and the MC29, has picked an internal deletion of a cellular gene. Neither the 5' end nor the 3' end is known, but it has picked an internal region, and the E26 virus has also picked an internal region on this and has linked it to yet another cell-derived element and GERG to make a transforming gene. So the point I was going to make, that's almost my penultimate slide. Could I have one more slide here? That is the Src model, which has actually caused a lot of confusion. This is the Src gene of Raus sarcoma virus at the 3' end here, and this is the cellular prototype. The bulk of the coding information comes from one proto-Src gene here, which, again, is not known where it starts. That makes a messenger RNA of 4 kilobases. The Src gene, the part of it that has found its way into the virus, is only about 1.5 kilobases. We don't know what that stands for. The end of the Src gene is not from this gene. Most of the end, that is another something like 20 or so codons, comes from an adjacent gene which is in the same locus. But the very end, the stop codon, does not come from anything that has been cloned as yet. We don't know where the UAG and an adjacent codon comes from. It could be from an adjacent gene, it could be from another chromosome, it could even be from another chicken. God knows where it came from. So, but the apparent similarity of these structures by liquid hybridization and the deceptive similarity in the size of the proteins which they make, this makes also a 60,000 Dalton protein, or is believed to be making such a protein. There is probably more made, which we don't know, maybe processed away, has led to the hypothesis that the viral transforming gene and the cellular prototype are the same, and the difference is only in increased dosage. That is, if you infect the cell with Rauch sarcoma virus, you double the gene dosage, and that's the answer to cancer. And that has been doing quite a while, this hypothesis. Now, thank you very much for the slides. So I would like to repeat then, and come now to the more theoretical part of the talk. The cellular transforming genes and the cellular proteome genes and the viral transforming genes are not isogenic. They are in all cases very different. Typically, a viral transforming gene is only a subset of a cellular prototype, and in more typically even, it is linked to elements of essential variant genes, and that is the transforming package. We do not know what the cellular prototypes do. Now, two arguments indicate that the qualitative differences between cellular proto-onc genes and viral transforming genes are essential for the transforming function of one and the lack of transforming function of the other. One is a common sense type of argument. There's the overwhelming evidence that cellular proto-onc genes are expressed in many normal cells at all times during various stages of differentiation and development, and even as long as they are alive. In fact, you can probably conclude that a cell is dead if MYC is not transcribed, or SARC is not transcribed, or FES is not transcribed, or FOS is not transcribed. That sounds almost too trivial to be true. Nowadays, you have to take it out of the cell, clone it in the plasmid vector or in a retrovirus, and put it back into a cell, preferably a 3T3 cell, and then convince Benjamin Lewing that the cell doesn't look transformed, and then you can convince the majority of the cell readers that proto-onc genes are not transforming. During that process, you usually cut off the ends of the cell, you add a promoter at the head and shoot it up from the rear with an enhancer from SV40, and you put some introns and exons in it, maybe some SV40 genes and neomycin at the end. But that does help to convince other readers. And it is still not as good as any normal cell that's alive that expresses this, but it does help to convince people that they don't transform. And such experiments have been published. In fact, just this month by Mike Bishop, he has published that with SARC. Interesting, isn't it? But Howard Tamin has published it too. He has put proto-SARC in a reticular endotheliosis virus vector, doesn't transform. Has done it with proto-RAS, doesn't transform, but when he takes the viral genes, it does transform. We have done that with MC29 virus in collaboration with George Vandewoude or Terry Robbins, doesn't transform. So in all of these cases, the proto-onc genes don't transform, at least as far as I know, and the viral genes do. There are, of course, these apparent exceptions that have gained notoriety. That is, the proto-MOS gene of the cell was taken out of the cell, linked to a viral LTR, which is a viral promoter enhancer package at the 5' end, and the same has been done with RAS. That was put into a 3T3 cell, and the 3C3 cell rounded up. Now, that has been interpreted as direct evidence for transforming potential of a cellular gene. I have two reservations about that. One is, the genes that were taken out of the cell were not genes. They were sequences which coincide with the viral transforming genes. The 5' ends of proto-MOS are not known, and the 5' ends of proto-RAS were also chopped off in the process. They were linked to LTRs, and they have transformed 3T3 cells. There's the second qualification. Transformation of 3T3 cells is not necessarily an accurate measure of cancer or carcinogenesis. It was shown that the proto-MOS gene linked to LTR does not transform primary cells, as George Vandewoude told me just last week in Denver. And it has been shown, as I come back in a minute, that the proto-RAS gene, when it's linked to LTR, also does not transform primary cells, human or rodent primary cells alike. So the question is now, are there any conditions under which proto-onc genes can cause cancer? Is there any basis onto which we can rely? And I said there's one case on which all of these speculations indeed rest, and that is the rare occasions when proto-onc genes have functioned essentially as accidental parents of retroviral transforming genes. And that has made him the center or the focus of research in, I would say, 80% of the papers that have been published in the last 2 years in certain journals. Now, in order to appreciate the argument why we know about this, although we cannot even produce that, nobody has been able to produce the transduction of cellular genes into retroviruses forming retroviral transforming genes. That seems to be an extremely rare event. There are few places on the earth where that can be done, but very rare. And reproducibly only one, as far as I know. You know, in New York, it's clumsy. So it's rare. So the in order to appreciate that argument, I would have to tell you a little more about retrovirology. Retroviruses with transforming genes are a rather unorthodox bunch among parasites, all parasites. I already pointed out they are obligatory carcinogens, but they have an extremely poor showing as carcinogens. They never have caused an epidemic. Nobody has heard of an epidemic of Rauch sarcomavirus wiping out chicken or Harvey sarcomavirus wiping out rats. Despite now the relaxed rules that Paul Berg has relaxed lately, we can clone them everywhere. Nothing has ever happened. Not even E. coli has gotten cancer with Sark genes in it. So they also are unorthodox in that, unlike other parasites, they do not have a natural reservoir of hosts or hostesses. I think it's important to point that out because certain viruses that Bob Gallo worked with only have hosts. They don't have hostesses anymore. Seems to me. So retroviruses have neither one of those with ONC genes, and they're also not in the germline. And it was on that basis, that on this paradoxical situation, that I think Hübner sort of more intuitively than molecularly, obviously, postulated already in 69, that the transforming genes of retroviruses must be somewhere in the cell and transduced out of the cell by some kind of a transduction. And that could be, in fact, proven in the 70s when ONC genes were discovered and when hybridization with cells was possible. There were prototypes found in the cell. Now, since there is no significant sequence homology between proto-ONC genes and essential virion genes ever, in no case that I know of, this transduction must be a rather rare event. It relies entirely on illegitimate recombination, and that is an extremely rare event. And in fact, it has to be double illegitimate recombination because you take a sequence totally unrelated to the virus into the virus vector in order to generate the virus. If only one step has been taken, that might generate a transforming gene, but not a transducible virus. If that were not such a rare event, we would probably look totally different tomorrow than we do today, and again, the day after that, we would look totally different again. Watson and Craig, and also Gregor Mendel, have protected against illegitimate recombination quite well. And this is why nobody has been able yet to design a reproducible system of transduction of ONC genes into retroviruses. We have to rely on Peyton Rouse, John Maloney, Bill Hardy, or a few people. Werner Kirsten? Yes. Where's Werner? Yeah, Werner Kirsten to do that, but they cannot reproduce their own experiment. And they're honorable men. I mean, this is... it is entirely consistent... with the nature of the accident. It is an accident. So, but it is on this basis, on this accidental parenthood of transforming genes that the proto-ONC genes are suspected to be cancer genes by themselves. Now, their role as potential cancer genes is viewed in laboratories, which is now a large number of laboratories that are studying this, in terms of two hypotheses that I would like to distinguish first and then discuss the few examples that are available. One I would call the one gene, one cancer hypothesis, and the other is the multi-gene, one cancer hypothesis. The one gene, one cancer hypothesis essentially is the oncogene hypothesis of Hübner and Todaro. It postulates that activation of an inactive cellular oncogene, which is functionally equivalent to a retroviral transforming gene, is sufficient to convert a normal cell into a tumor cell. Some investigators have postulated that this activation is simply the result of increasing the dosage of that gene. And that can be accomplished at the transcriptional level or by gene amplification, or even more directly by infecting the cell with the virus. So either you put the normal cellular gene, you increase the transcription by putting a better promoter or enhancer on it, or you amplify the gene, and that will give you more products, or you infect it with a virus which contains a functionally equivalent transforming gene. This view has been termed the quantitative model. It means that a normal gene is just regulated up, and it assumes that the two are functionally equivalent. A variant of this one gene one cancer hypothesis is suggests that activation is a mutational step, that is a qualitative change, but it's still the same gene. That could be a point mutation. The famous example of the summer of 1982 was the RAS mutation that causes the bladder carcinoma cancer. Come back to that in a second. And this view is termed the qualitative model of the one gene, one cancer hypothesis. Now, the one gene, one cancer hypothesis hasn't been doing so well lately, so there's progress, and we have moved into multi-gene, one cancer hypothesis. More genes is better in this business. The multi-gene one cancer hypothesis postulates that activation of a proto-onc gene is necessary. We don't want to lose them. They are fundraising genes. But it is unlike the corresponding viral transforming gene is no longer sufficient to cause the tumor. In order to cause the tumor, one proto-onc gene is supposed to be activated, but in addition, another one or yet another gene functions as a helper gene. This hypothesis fits the view nicely how virus-negative tumors have been thought to all along to be generated by multi-steps. Peyton Rouse, Bernblum, all fools, all of these people are quite happy with a multi-gene one cancer hypothesis. It fits all. And in addition, we have now models to hybridize for, to clone for. We can now look for proto-onc genes rather than fishing in the dark. So from that point of view, this view has been quite successful. However, since viral onc genes have yet to be dissociated into functional subsets, that is an initiation or maintenance subset, which could complement each other or could be complemented by some other unknown cellular genes, this model has killed the precedent that we had in the freezers. We had our precedent, all of you could say, of course the RAS mutation must be important because in the freezer I have Harvey and Kirsten and they can do it. Even if I haven't proven it yet, I have sequence homology and that makes me strong. But now we are saying the precedent is no longer Harvey and Kirsten because Harvey and Kirsten can do it by themselves. We need now MYC and RAS to do the job. And that leaves the hypothesis without precedent and, as I believe, essentially entirely without proof. Now, two kinds of assays are done to test these hypotheses. This is one gene, one cancer, or multi-gene, one cancer. One assay is to correlate activation of proto-onc genes structurally or in terms of expression with cancer. That is, you take 100 cancers, Burkitt lymphomas, and say, is in all of these Burkitt lymphomas MYC translocated, or is RAS activated, or is FES removed? That's the one approach. Or the other approach is that, initiated by Jeff Cooper, that you take the DNA of a tumor cell and transfect it on certain cell lines, of course, usually 3T3 lines, and then you assay, is there a transforming function associated with any of the DNA? Can it directly transform the morphology of the cells, the recipient cells, from a normal phenotype into a transformed phenotype? That's a functional assay. Most of these experiments apply to human tumors, have identified MYC genes or RAS-related genes as the cause of these tumors. Now, I would start with discuss one or two examples. One is the example that proto-MYC, an activated proto-MYC, is the cause of B-cell lymphomas. It was first postulated by Bill Hamert, as far as I know, that activation of proto-MYC is the cause of the chicken B-cell lymphoma or chicken leukosis, which is a clonal cancer that is caused in a small fraction of animals. It's important to point out it's not in all animals, in a small fraction of animals which are infected by an avian leukosis virus without a transforming gene. It's a gene, it's a retrovirus with GERC, pollen, and for no onc gene. The tumor appears, that's also important to remember, only after a latent period of at least 5 to 6 months. Now, Hayward proposed in 81 that if a retrovirus is integrated next to proto-MYC within about 5 kilobases, as later molecular studies have shown, it could lend its 3' LTR, which contains a promoter and enhancer, to that neighboring proto-onc gene, fire it up or propel it into action or something, whatever the terminology is, and then that would functionally equivalent to the transforming gene of MC29, which we know so well, and cause a tumor, a B-cell lymphoma. The hypothesis is termed downstream promotion for that reason. However, as I already pointed out earlier, the proto-MYC gene and the transforming genes of MC29 are structurally different. The viral transforming gene has a 1.5 kilobase GERC sequences linked to MYC, which may make a difference. There are point mutations between the common MYC sequences, and the cell has an exon, a first exon, which may be largely non-coding, but is not shared with the virus. Now the observation that Haymood made in the original paper, that many, the majority, like 80% of the B-cell lymphomas express mRNA linked to a viral LTR at an elevated expression, is entirely consistent with the hypothesis. However, not all chicken B-cell lymphomas contain such an RNA, and not all of them express MYC at 100% at an elevated expression. It's only 70 to 80%. Now, sure, Robert Koch is long dead, and in cancer you don't need 100% proof anymore, but it doesn't help, at least the hypothesis. You have to invoke an alternate mechanism in this case. Now, what's more difficult to explain by the hypothesis is the long latent period and the clonality of the tumor that arises. If you consider that the chicken measures about, the chicken genome is about 1 million kilobases, an integration within 5 kilobases of proto-MYC is said to be sufficient, believing in the hypothesis now, to activate the gene and to generate the first tumor cell, 1 in 200,000 infections should generate the first tumor cell. The chicken has at least, as far as I know, 10 to the 7 uncommitted B cells, so there are plenty of B cells around that could be infected, and the virus titer after a couple of days of infection is essentially inexhaustible. Hey, Rubin tells me in a good chicken you get a titer sometimes of 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 10 infectious units per milliliter. So the first tumor cell should be generated within hours after the virus titer has been reached, or within minutes, I would say, and the latent period should be very short, should be a few days only. And in addition, the tumor should not be clonal, in particular if you see the latent period to last 6 months. There should be many integrations next to proto-MYC, and the tumor should be not clonal. None of these things can be explained by the downstream prime motion hypothesis. The hypothesis can also, of course, not explain why the phenotype is of the disease is really very different from that of the virus. MC29 causes primarily carcinomas, acute leukemias of the type of myelocytomatosis, and it causes even sarcomas, but as far as I know, almost never B-cell lymphomas. So none of these things are explained by the hypothesis. Now, when the DNA of the tumor was assayed by the second method that I mentioned, that is transfection onto three cells, originally Jeff Cooper and Paul Niemann found that there was a DNA indeed in these B-cell lymphomas which transformed three T3 cells. But that DNA was not activated proto-MYC. It was another DNA which has been named B-lymph, I assume a gene for B-cell lymphoma. Now, this DNA is thought to be, as Jeff explained this morning, to be the maintenance gene of the B-cell lymphoma, and proto-MYC is believed to be an initiation gene, an early gene. It would have somehow activated B-lymph to jump into action to maintain the transformed phenotype. Now, this is consistent with the hypothesis, but the 3T3 cell transfection assay obviously does not measure any proto-MYC function, whatsoever, so the role of proto-MYC in that process is entirely hypothetical. And I don't know of any evidence that B-lymph or a combination of B-lymph and activated proto-MYC or any other combination has transformed B-cells in the meantime. The hypothesis does also not explain the assumption why proto-MYC is functionally inadequate to transform a chicken cell. In MC29, the virus, of course, transforms any substrate cell in a very short time without the benefit of helper genes such as B-lymph, and doesn't need any of the helper genes. So we have left the viral precedent into a multi-gene, in this case a two-gene, one cancer hypothesis, and asked the cellular gene to carry out a function for which we have no viral model. And we have, as I said, no direct proof. Now the same thing has happened with the Burkitt lymphoma. In this case, there's no virus to activate the lymph gene. In this case, translocation of the gene is thought to be the method of activating a cellular gene. It was projected by cancer thinkers such as George Klein and John Cairns three years ago, it was projected that rearrangements and translocations could activate cellular genes, cellular potential cancer genes, would provide. They move them out of their old neighborhood into a new neighborhood. They see new enhancers. They see new exciting things like promoters and other things, new neighborhood, and they become activated into action. When you move around, you often get stimulated. And that's what they projected now for potential cancer genes. In this case, proto-MYC, which is in the human, could I have the next slide? That's actually a slide that I took from Newsweek, one of the major journals in the business. Jump this one, the next one. It shows next one. That's the downstream promotion model. I can come back to it. See, that's where the mid GNS and commons are made. This is from Newsweek, March. It's a bit obsolete or outdated now. It's already 4 months old. But I just put it in for you. In this case, the proteomic in the human is on chromosome 8, and it's translocated either to chromosome 14 or to 2 or 22. And the breakpoint or the crossover point is, in fact, in many of these translocations, in the proteomic gene, and it separates the first exon from the next two exons. And then it moves it into a new neighborhood now of chromosome 14, and it is believed that this then has the result of activating the gene. So although this is biochemically not very easy to understand, because the linkage is actually 5'5' head-to-head to an immunoglobulin gene, and it could still function as an enhancer, it could not provide it with a new promoter. But what is more difficult to reconcile with the hypothesis is there are some more recent data that in some of these translocations, the breakpoint is up to 50 kilobases 5' of proteomic. So in essence, the proteomic moves with its whole neighborhood or its whole village into another chromosome. And that is not, at least not, there's no model, no in vitro model, how this could stimulate a gene. It would have to stimulate it over 50 kilobases. It's always possible, but it's not very easy to see. And most recently, five laboratories, including actually Carlo Coaches, have shown that in fact the MYC is not translocated at all in a significant minority of Burkitt lymphomas. It was shown in field leaders in rabbits and Hamlin rabbits laboratory in Cambridge and by Carlo Coche, that the proteomic stays at home and something 3' of it is translocated reciprocally again with another chromosome. And that, of course, I think kills the translocation as an activation mechanism altogether, because the gene is not translocated. It is not translocated. But not MYC. We're talking about MYC. I'm not talking about light chain carcinogenesis yet. I talk about MYC carcinogenesis. MYC stays. It's the next thing. I would like to point that out again. I'm only taught proto-onc chains. It has a new downstream neighborhoods, 10 kilobases downstream. I do not see how this could activate it. It is always possible. Miracles exist. But it is not translocated. That was initially proposed to be the mechanism. And it is not rearranged. Something happens downstream. God knows what that does. But I don't see any model or any mechanism how that would activate a gene. In addition, I mean, since the mechanism of action is supposed to be elevated transcription, there is, as far as I can read the literature, not the scientists, of course, there is no consensus as to whether the translocation, no matter how it is, 5', 3' in the middle, or not translocated or translocated, is no consensus that the translocations lead to consistent increase in MYC transcription. Several laboratories, including one from this man here, Dr. Gallo is his name, a leading MYC investigator, have observed that a MYC oncologist, that MYC is not transcribed at an elevated level in tumor cells. Leader says that, and Hamlin says that, and Rabbit says that, and George Klein says that. Although Carlo doesn't agree with that, I know that. So there is, I would say, there's not a lot of consensus at the moment that no matter what happens to MYC, translocated or not, that the result is an increased transcription. Now, the view that enhanced expression of MYC may be sufficient to cause Burkitt lymphomas has also been challenged recently in Leader's lab and in Pardee's lab. They have shown that in normal cells, cell cycle-dependent MYC peak levels of transcription reach or exceed those that are seen in tumor cells. So they are not tumor cells while they're doing this. And enhanced transcription also has been shown not to depend on MYC translocation in a number of other examples. Pardee, for example, has shown that chemical carcinogenesis leads to enhanced MYC transcription without a translocation. And there are a number of non-Burkitt lymphomas in which nothing is translocated, not even MYC. As far as I know, other things are possibly translocated. And again, MYC is transcribed at an elevated level. So translocation is not necessary for enhanced transcription, and enhanced transcription of MYC is seen in normal cells, doesn't seem to be necessarily a cause of tumor. Now, since the quantitative model has been doing not so well, the qualitative model has been checked. Mutations have been checked in translocated MYC. Now, Rabbits and Hamlin in Cambridge have published that a translocated MYC differed from the germline equivalent in 16 point mutations in one case, but Phil Leader at the same time has sequenced the translocated MYC and said it was absolutely identical to the germline equivalent. So if you summarize this, that means there is no, there's neither translocation, nor rearrangement, nor elevated transcription, nor mutation common to all MYC genes in Burkitt lymphomas. So I would conclude that this casts serious doubt on the view that MYC activation is sufficient to cause the disease. In fact, it raises the question whether it has anything to do with it whatsoever. In addition, now, the transfection assay has been used on Burkitt lymphomas, and as with the chicken B-cell lymphoma, the MYC did not transform 3T3 cells, but another gene called BLIM has been seen to transform 3T3 cells, and that is related to the chicken counterpart, and that has now supported, again, the two-gene, one-cancer hypothesis, that MYC activates LIM and LIM maintains the tumor. Now, the same criticism applies that I raised for the chicken story. The 3T3 assay does not measure any function of proto-MYC, and a combination of proto-MYC and BLIM has not been seen, as far as I know, to transform any B cells yet. And also in this case, the BLIM activation was only seen cell lines. I have not seen any reports that it is activated in primary tumors. Now, this is what I have to say about the example of proto-MYC. There are other examples which I don't discuss. I would like to spend a few more minutes on RAS in order to conclude my opinions. In the summer of 1982, several laboratories extracted or applied the 3T3 transfection assay to several carcinomas, in this case, a human bladder carcinoma. Could I have the lights again, please? I like to be illuminated. If it's possible. They have used the transfection assay to transform 3T3 cells and found in human bladder carcinoma cell lines that there was a DNA that transformed 3T3 cell which was not found in normal cells, and that DNA was shown to be the sequence homologue or the prototype of the RAS gene of Harvey sarcoma virus. The DNA was cloned and sequenced, and it was shown to differ from the normal counterpart, as Peter Seberg just described, in one singular mutation in the 12th codon. It went from glycine to valine, and since this mutation conferred 3T3 cell transforming function to the DNA, it was concluded that this was the carcinogen that transformed the human bladder into the human bladder carcinoma. That's at least what it said in Nature and in many other journals. However, subsequent work that has looked for the mutation in primary tumors has failed miserably. Over 60 primary tumors have been published that have been looked for that mutation, and it was not found in a single one of those. And maybe others have been looked for and haven't been published. They wouldn't have an easy time to be accepted in Nature, I guarantee you. In addition, it has been tried very hard to get that mutation to transform anything but 3T3 cells, and that also hasn't been doing so well. Primary rodent cells did not get transformed, not even by Weinberg. And Ruth Sager in Boston has tried very hard to shove it into human primary cells, and she got it in there. It was expressed, but these human fibroblasts, that is, foreskin cells, remained untransformed. So the 3T3, they remained rigid. I'm sorry, no, frigid. Oh, rigid. What? Maybe both. God knows. So it doesn't transform primary cells, and it isn't found in primary tumors. Now, of course, at MIT, they're very smart and fast and thoughtful. So they have... So in an effort now to explain the poor showing of proto-RAS in primary cells and its complete absence in primary tumors, they thought that it must be a cancer gene after all, and it would function with some helper genes. So a two-gene, one-cancer-gene hypothesis has been activated. The helper gene was, of course, not obvious because it couldn't be found in any of these assays. So it was they looked in the table of proto-onc genes, and Weinberg came up with proto-MYC from a human, from a mouse plasmacytoma, or MC29 right away, right from the provirus, and Ruli at Cold Spring Harbor used adenovirus to help out the RAS gene that couldn't do it by itself. Now, when they put those mixed doubles onto primary cells, a few cells survived the treatment and transformed. The rat cells, of course, human cells were even tighter. And it is only a few survivors that we are talking about. Now, of course, this is now hot business, big business, companies involved, stocks, prices, monthly prices of $100,000 and more. So there's not much time for control. But nevertheless, Rulli checked the expression. He found indeed that the RAS gene was in some of the transformants. It wasn't expressed at a higher level than normal in some of them, but he checked that. He did even a control. He used unmutated RAS, and then it didn't work. The other lab, which used MYC, didn't have that much time. They did not say whether the DNA was in the transformants or whether calcium phosphate or the carrier transformed, and they did not check whether the mutated, the point mutation was necessary to do it, or whether MC29 MYC or only activated cellular gene could do. That wasn't checked in these cases. And it would have been interesting in one particular case, because one construction that was used by the Weinberg lab was a activated proto-MYC from a mouse plasmacytoma, from which the first exon had been removed, and it had an enhancer was attached at the 3' end from SV40 to stimulate it from the rear. But even as far as we know, even the most potent rear end enhancers do not work without a front end promoter, and that was missing. But anyway, it worked in that assay. So the MYC-related genes were proposed in this kind of scenario to convert the rat primary cells into an indefinitely dividing, essentially 3D3 cell equivalent, a process which they called immortalization, which is, I think, applies to the authors as well. And the role of the mutated RAS, the role of the mutated RAS was said to be now to take on these 3T3 cells, these 3T3 equivalents, and transform them as it used to do in the good old days in 1982. But the proposal did not explain at all why immortalization was required for the process, because we all know that primary cells, even if they are kept in these laboratories, can potentially at least divide 50 times before they peter out. And a tumor can be formed with 50 potential mitoses, even with a not immortal cell. And in animals, it is formed, again, without prior immortalization. And it is also not explained why the RAS gene would need MYC and the MC29 helper would need RAS in order to do the job. The immortalization function obviously remained untested. It was only a theoretical thing. It was not tested independently. Only the two things together had a function in this assay. Moreover, in the homologous system, MC29 does not, of course, need an immortalization function. It causes tumors in animals or in primary chicken cell all by itself. And most tumor cells that you cultivate from a chicken MC29 tumor are not immortal if tested in cell culture. And there's also no precedent for a function of proto-RAS in a multi-step scenario, since the RAS gene of Harvey and Kirsten sarcoma viruses can transform primary cells and can cause tumors in rats and mice without the help of MYC or adenovirus E1A or any other helper gene. Likewise, there's of course no evidence that the mixed doubles have ever been seen to be the cause of any natural tumor. I've never heard of a rat that suffered from a tumor induced by a human bladder carcinoma gene and MC29. So it might be relevant to something, but it hasn't been shown to be relevant to any natural tumor yet. Now, the failure of the mutated proto-RAS to behave like the Harvey or Kirsten virus is, in my opinion, the tremendous structural differences between the two genes. There are other examples. I cannot list them all, but I could just list a few. Lloyd Old has just published a paper in which he compared 5 different metastases of the same melanoma patients. One of them had the mutation, and 4 others did not. Obviously, the conclusion is that the RAS mutation was not necessary to cause the tumor and was not necessary to cause the metastases. O'Balmain in England published a paper in which he showed that by chemical carcinogenesis, you can induce benign papillomas and malignant carcinomas in the skin of mice, and some of the benign papillomas contained mutated RAS and some of the carcinomas did. But only 5 to 10% of the benign papillomas ever developed into malignant carcinomas. And many of those, so the majority, over 90%, regressed, although some of them did have the mutated RAS gene. So obviously the RAS gene was not sufficient to push the tumor from a benign into a malignant state. And many of the carcinomas did not contain the mutated RAS gene anyway. So the RAS gene in this case was neither necessary nor was it sufficient to cause the tumor. And there are other examples along these lines were published by a Dutch group recently in which the RAS gene was found in some metastases but not in others. So in conclusion then, CD3 cell transforming function or mutation of the RAS gene is very rarely associated with primary tumors, and mutated RAS does not transform human or rodent primary cells. So therefore it is impossible at this point to conclude that the mutation is sufficient to cause any of the tumors, and it is very difficult to even say that they were necessarily involved in any of the carcinogenic events. It would appear, however, that a consistent correlation exists between RAS mutations and the ability of that DNA to transform 3T3 cells. And that, I think, is more an impeachment of the 3T3 assay, which has been very useful all along, than anything against the RAS gene. The results would indicate that the 3T3 cell assay cannot distinguish between primary carcinogens and mutations which are consequential, coincidental, or even prior or after the tumor, which evolve during tumor progression. Moreover, the preponderance of 3T3 cell transformation negatives among carcinomas, there's usually 80 or 90% are negatives, means that suggests that either no genes have caused these tumors or the assay was unable to pick them up. So if you are a 3T3 cell fascist, so to speak, if you really believe in the assay, then I would have to offer you another hypothesis. This would be the no gene, one cancer hypothesis. Because that is exactly what the assay says. The majority of the tumors, the carcinomas, are negative with the assay. So Harry Rubin likes that hypothesis. That something else God-given causes a tumor and genes have nothing to do with it. Or alternatively, you would have to say the assay cannot detect them. So, again, in favor of proto-onc genes, maybe we should say a few last words. The one thing we could say is it is, of course, possible to argue that proto-onc genes, because of their persuasive relationship to viral onc genes, could possibly form as tumor genes. But in this case, we could not argue anymore that they are causative. They could be non-specific, just directly causative. They could be non-specific causative agents. So you could argue, because occasionally we see mutations in these genes, they do play a role, but this role could be substituted by something else. It would be a causative, non-specific type of mutation. In order to support this view, we would have to identify some alternatives. We would have to find out what could replace proto-RAS in the 90% negatives to cause the tumor, or what could replace proto-MYC if it's not translocated in order to cause the Burkitt lymphoma. That has yet to be done. So I would say additional work is necessary to explain any tumor that could be possibly caused by a proto-onc gene. And it's my opinion now that the proto-onc genes, which already have been called enemy from within, may be proto-enemies from within, or perhaps friends. Thank you.
Question. Ralph, maybe in the style of the earlier one, we really should have a couple of questions and interchange on that.
Not long.
No. Before, surely Carlo will ask you, but I wanted to make Peter once in a serious question. If you go back to the avian leukosis, or a virus without an onc gene that can reproducibly produce leukemia, in certain circumstances, 100% of inoculated animals get disease. What would be your positive thoughts of the molecular mechanism of that event? Or you would like to just say, I don't know, and leave it at that? Do you have a positive idea? Let's say the Hayward model is dead. Now we're talking about viruses that do exist, that do cause leukemia. What would you think about how?
Well, in the chicken, there is no such thing as 100%. You asked the chicken. I mean, we have to stay at one organism at a time. That may have to do because nobody has inbred chicken lines like they do have to mice. With mice, it came about because Furth and McDowell, before they even know about Ludwig Kohs and viruses, they were breeding these mice to get leukemia. And they probably selected for the genes we should all know about it. Those are probably... You asked me about how viruses without own genes can do it. He doesn't want to hear that. It is, of course, only the virus. Yeah.
No. Peter, no. I want to say this. Wait a minute. Now, wait. This is serious. What about animal systems where you can produce leukemia 100% of the time with a simple inoculation?
No,
you use the system that you argued inbred mice, but chickens don't get it all the time. They get it enough time. We have to be serious. You inoculate chickens, you do get leukemia with avian leukosis virus. Cat leukemia virus. I mean, Bill Jarrett tells me 100% of kittens inoculated at the right age will get leukemia. Bovine leukemia virus in cows is causing leukemia. You put it into sheep, it's 100% of the cases. You know, I don't want to get into all of the bits, but I think it's important to deal with it. Kawakami showed with gibbon ape leukemia virus, and gibbon apes are not in bread.
I don't know anything about viruses without OMP genes. They don't even have PX. You see, how could I know? No, I was talking about the role of proto-OMP genes in cancers. And I think the evidence we have that is not as strong as it could be. It is. But the others, I agree, that's the ultimate question. Those are the real retroviruses. The retroviruses with OMP genes. They have caused maybe the 50 or 100 tumors from which the viruses were isolated. And that is certainly not enough to keep the funds coming in as they came in so far, if we are honest about that. So we got to work with Bob Gallo to find some more relevant systems.
No, I agree with Peter completely. I mean, that's why we focus on the viruses without ONC genes that cause cancer in nature. But you still did discuss avian leukosis virus, and you didn't, I wouldn't say attacked, but you minimized Bill Hayward's model of promoter insertion turning on the MYC gene. Now, with these viruses, you want to conclude, we know they cause leukemia, we know they exist in nature, and you don't want to say what you think the molecular mechanism is or the best likelihood. You don't want to give a positive suggestion, just that's the big problem to figure out. That's the way we leave it.
Well, the only consolation I can take is I'm not alone. You know, I mean, I think ever since Ellerman and Bang, people have tried to understand how viruses without ONC genes cause tumors, and that I cannot be better than they are is not so terrible. You see, I mean, you can actually criticize Beethoven without writing the 10th symphony. A criticism is not necessarily oblige you to be better. You see, you can be a valid critic.
Okay, now. Before Carlo makes his comment, I wanted to get it into Burkitt lymphoma, because it seemed to me, look, and I'm not involved in the MYC Burkitt lymphoma anymore, not for years, but it would seem to me that the consistency of the finding, and not just in man, but in, you don't like him, but rats and mice also have MYC involvement, either translocated or immunoglobulin genes brought somewhere close to them. Now that's three systems. Plus the B cell lymphoma of chickens, going back to Hayward's model, that MYC is implicated. Doesn't that consistency temper your critique of the proto-oncogene ideas in the Burkitt lymphoma and in related B cell lymphomas? Not in the least.
No, it helped me back for years. I mean, I would have said, it literally did. I mean, it sounds like a joke. It's true. I mean, I was spellbound for a long time. I mean, it is intriguing. Why does it happen in the neighborhood of proto-OncoMYC? But now the exceptions are coming in. In some cases, it isn't translocated. In others, it's so far away that it doesn't make a difference. So I think that is intriguing. MYC has something to do with the cell. I'm fully convinced. The cell needs it, and it probably, but...
Peter, but not only you don't read, but you also don't listen. But in the case of the MYC translocation, there is a consensus among a major laboratory that, in fact, there is a deregulation of the MYC gene that is involved in the translocation, whether it's rearranged to the heavy chain or whether the light chains are translocated to MYC, it doesn't change anything. Since the normal control in this case would be the normal MYC on normal chromosome 8, because it is present in the same cell, and there is a dramatic difference in level of MYC transcript between the translocated MYC or the MYC involved in the translocation versus the normal MYC on normal chromosome 8. So what you were saying is absolutely not correct. In fact, there is absolute consensus among major laboratory that the major difference in Burkitt lymphoma is the transcription of the regulation of the MYC gene, which is involved in the translocation.
Well, only one laboratory fuses the human cells to mouse cells before they measure the altered transcription. And I don't consider that exactly a physiological
assay. You could look
assay.
In Burkitt lymphoma cells themselves, and you would find that only the translocated one is transcribed,
well,
where the normal one is not.
There I have to disagree with you. If I read, I'm only reading the literature, and one of them is this man's literature. They do not agree that then you can detect significantly
altered. Or at least you don't read enough papers, because it has been described over and over.
By one laboratory.
Carlo, can I make a point about it that's in between the both of you? I think that what Peter's referring to is that not all labs have reported, I know what you're going to say, not all labs have reported high-level transcription. You have. And I think your data speak for themselves. They're the most thorough, they're the most complete, and in the system you have them in, I have no doubts you're right. There are three or four other laboratories in Burkitt lymphoma compared to EBV transform lines or normal B cells activated. With the lipopolysaccharide or whatever it be, that the levels of transcription are not far different. But I think all the laboratories that I've heard and I would have the same opinion myself, although still not active in it, is that there is constitutive expression at minimum abnormal in the Burkitt lymphoma, that it can't turn off. I think nobody has said anything different than that. So I think the laboratories involved, I think I heard of them all in the last few weeks, were all believing anyway that there's abnormal constitutive level, if not hyperexpression, of MYC in Burkitt lymphoma, in rat B lymphomas, in mouse B lymphomas, in chicken B lymphomas.
In chemically transformed cells and in urinary carcinomas, Reed Slayman in Science, April 1984, or read several other papers which I can give you right after this. Yeah. Or read Pardee in cell, in chemically transformed cells, or many others.
I'm going to read it. Is Jeff Cooper, Marianne Lane, do they want to make any?
Or in just stimulated B cells, in any fast dividing C cells.
Yeah. Okay. Peter, I agree with almost all of your criticisms, except, of course, those that apply directly to our own experiments.
To you. Yeah,
but
of course. No, I mean, I should. No, I think.
But so what I don't understand is why you're so easy on the viral oncogenes. If you take Abelson virus, mm-hmm. Rex Risser has shown that you can induce tumors with Abelson virus, which contains what you would call a good V-onc, mm-hmm. right? And you pass those tumors in mice, and there's strong selection.
I would
selection.
Call it onc. I don't even need the V because there are no others.
Huh?
I wouldn't use V-onc. I would just call it onc because I don't know any others. Yes,
right, but it's a good onc. But yet, if you pass those tumors in mice,
yes.
you actually select for loss of that Abelson onc along with the rest of Abelson. So by your criterion, then, that's an exception where you lose even a real onc.
Gene, and you...
So do we say it's not a real onc, or...?
He loses everything, or what does he retain?
He doesn't retain any virus.
And does he retain any cells?
It keeps forming a tumor, yeah.
It keeps forming a tumor. That must be interesting, yeah.
Is Bob Weinberg here? Has he been flown in?
All right,
Jeff,
Peter.
Wait a minute, Jeff. I wanted to answer.
I finally understand what you're trying to say.
Just a second. Perhaps you are aware of the data. I'm not too surprised about that. If you look at cells transformed by Raus sarcoma virus, for example, rat cells or others, initially the karyotype is completely normal, and the cell is transformed. And then as you passage it through mice, the passage is on, the karyotype becomes completely abnormal, and the cells become more and more metastatic, invasive, whatever they use, aggressive, enhanced, and tumorigenic, all of these things. So I think it's quite conceivable that you might even lose the initial oncogene in the process, and the tumor cell stays transformed, because the karyotype is totally screwed up in these cells. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rex Swisser cells are the same way.
Jeffrey.
I think that's right, but isn't that very much like the progression that you were saying doesn't make sense?
It doesn't occur
with the real oncogene.
Jeff, as soon as you talk, as we don't talk about proto-oncogenes, I'm no longer competent. I bet there is tumor progression. I would never argue with Peyton Rouse or Bernblum or Fools. I'm sure that exists. I just say, is there a role for proto-oncogenes in that progression? Is there a proven role for them? And I don't know of one single case yet.
I think all of us immunologists finally understand what's really happening here, Peter. You're coming in from the cold.
I realize that.
You really want to convert to immunology because basically what you're trying to say is that it isn't MYC that causes tumors, it's the immunoglobulin genes. It's all right, Peter.
I haven't said that yet. I have only said...
But I know you're leading up to it.
I have exactly said I'm not competent in gamma globulin carcinogenesis. It's possible.
This is just perhaps two minor points. The first is I agree with Jeff Cooper that the... If you look carefully, like Owen Witte and Cheryl Whitlock did, at Abelson leukemia virus transformation in vitro, that Abelson virus transformed in vitro pre-B cells undergo two stages of development, a first stage in which they are feeder layer dependent, but fully expressing the ABL gene as the GAG ABL transcript. Yet, you take those cells out of feeder layer, you put them in vivo, you put them in auger, and they're not tumors. A second magic event occurs later, which doesn't involve at least any visible change in the level of expression of ABL, but does involve the change of expression of other cellular genes, and maybe irrelevantly, maybe in an important cause and effect way, and you have a tumor. So at least in that case, the expression of the ABLE gene in its GAG-ABLE sequence is not a sufficient event for carcinogenesis. It may be a necessary event, but it's not sufficient. The second point, I think this one that goes back and forth about all of the activation of c-MYC, I think that you did propose at the very beginning an important criteria for an oncogene, and that is one that you can show that if you take away its expression, you take away the malignant phenotype. And that's very difficult for an activated cellular gene, that is, to take away its expression. But I think there are now means to try to decrease the effective transcription of cellular genes, various antigenetic schemes. And if one could demonstrate that the gene is not needed for the normal economy of the normal cell, that's the counterpart, then one can ask the question for the first time whether these genes have a necessary and sufficient role in maintenance of the malignant phenotype. But I agree, it hasn't been shown in a direct sense.
Carlo, you want to say a little more? Any other questions? Dr. Hofschneider?
I don't think I have a question. I'm not Dr. Hofschneider either. I just think I'd like to say two or three words. I think this is the only place that anybody has ever received a prize that has to undergo the third degree. I really congratulate Peter in standing up there. I really congratulate Ralph on nominating him and Bob Gallo in introducing him. And I'd like to add my congratulations to Peter for accepting the prize. It's the toughest prize I've ever seen anyone ever have to accept. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ken. Thank you very much.
Probably we was right to start yesterday. Stoma lectures with discussion, I think. We have this whole discussion, the talk of a tape. Maybe sometimes if you are interested in this tape, you can get it. Now, Peter, what happened here? I have to say something. I am now the honest person here. Okay. Peter, you have seen the things before you get it, you see. You know most of the things, and then you didn't get it. This time, you have seen the things before, and you get it also. Therefore, I would like to give you this nice picture. All people have seen it. It's not the name of the other person, and it's really new. It's your name under this. And I'm really glad to see you here today, this nice talk, this nice discussion, this nice audience. And now, probably the picture people know, and I would like to give it now to you. This is not a black box paper talk always. There's really was something in and something nice thing in. And I have to try to open it. Let's try this way. Let's try this way. Oh, you put it out. This is it now, Peter. And this is yours, I think. I hope you like it.
Thank you very much. Yes, this is
okay. Now there's again a rule that is now 3 or 4 years old. We have one of these pictures for the children of Fred Stolman. David Rosenau will take it home to Boston. Now to the evening, we have a fire this evening, not only inside, also outside. It is a fire more you can see and feel. Here's this fire you could live, I think. It was really a nice fire. It will be warm. It will be warm enough to go out. It's not so very warm, but it's warm enough. Outside, you get all things you need this evening. It means sausage. We call other things Buchweizenpfanne.